Welcome. I'm your host, Henry Arslanian, and welcome to the Future Money Podcast. My goal with this podcast is very simple. It's to go deep in some of the biggest ideas, trends, and developments we are seeing in the field of crypto, and hopefully empower you with this information, and then let you make your own decision on what their impact can be on the future of money and finance. To do this, I invite each week one of the leading figures of the global crypto community to have a one-on-one conversation amongst crypto aficionados and discuss some of these topics. My guest today is Talal Taba, the co-founder of CoinMina, a federally regulated crypto exchange regulated by the Central Bank of Bahrain. One thing that you may not know about Talal is that in his university days, he used to be a semi-pro FIFA player. So here we go, another great example that video games can get you very far. Talal, great to have you with us today on the Future of Money podcast.
Pleasure is all mine, Henry. Pleasure is all mine.
So Talal, as we kick it off, can you maybe share us for the audience, maybe a couple minutes about you, your background, how, where you were and how you started CoinMina, and also a bit about CoinMina itself as well.
Well, to be completely honest, I didn't start CoinMina. My partners did. I joined them post-ideation. But to give you a quick background about myself, I'm a Jordanian-German national. I studied industrial. So I was born and raised in Jordan, moved to the U.S. to study industrial engineering at Purdue University. Then after that, worked for PwC. So I'm a
great
PwC
firm.
Alumni. Yeah, great firm. Learned a lot there. So I'm definitely grateful to the opportunities that PwC gave me in terms of seeing many industries. One of the industries that I happened to see was banking and finance. And I realized that, all right, that industry is still operating in the traditional world. That was around the same time that I started getting into crypto. I left PwC to join a Saudi family office. That was quite an aggressive move, I would say, because I moved to a place that didn't have a structure. I didn't have a contract for the first 2 years and basically was leaving like a steady career growth to move to Saudi. Luck happened where I convinced my Saudi boss or ex-Saudi boss to buy a good amount of Bitcoin and helped him exit that. And that's when I started my first company called Jibril, along with my partner Yazan. And that company basically builds financial products on Ethereum and it has its own token. And then basically we get approached a lot by people in the Middle East saying, where can I buy or sell Bitcoin? Or where can I buy and sell Ethereum? And even though there were a couple of companies in the Middle East already doing that, we felt that there's definitely a market opportunity. So yeah, I basically have two partners in CoinMina, Dina Sam'an, who used to be the director of Ops at BitOasis, and Yazan, my partner at Jibril. And yeah, basically we, all three of us share the same goals, the same ambitions, the same values. So we just went for it and still in the beginning of the road, I guess.
And what is the goal, I would say, with CoinMina? Obviously, you guys are a regulated exchange in the Middle East. What is the goal? Is to be an exchange servicing the retail, institutional market? Can you tell us more about that so the audience can understand exactly what is the commercial objective of the company?
Of course. So the commercial objective of the company is actually to become the biggest crypto business in the Middle East. And notice that I say crypto business and not crypto exchange. Our current offering is an exchange. You can deposit riyal, you can deposit dirham, you can deposit Omani via your card or wire, or obviously you can deposit in crypto and then move to the other side. So fiat to crypto and crypto to fiat. We've seen this trend play out everywhere in the world where you can't have proper crypto innovation if you don't have reliable rails going in and out, which is why we actually went to Bahrain, right? I live in Dubai, my family's in Dubai, but yet my company is in Bahrain. And that's because they were able to launch very cohesive, comprehensive crypto regulations that are done on a federal level where the central bank, the ministries, everyone's on the same page. And as a crypto exchange, one of the most important things is having reliable banking relationships. As you can imagine, it's much easier dealing with a bank when you're both regulated by the same entity because the compliance-related excuse no longer works because we're also federally regulated the same way the banks are, albeit different license, different requirements. So to answer your question, CoinMina today allows you to move between crypto to cash and cash to crypto, but in the coming 3 years, we aim to provide financial services that are built on top of crypto rails.
Okay, I want to talk about there's a couple of things I want to discuss in the podcast today. One of them is really what's happening in crypto across the Middle East. You know, we often hear about the crypto ecosystems in Asia, in North America, and increasingly about the crypto ecosystems in Latin America and Africa. For some reason, actually, we don't often talk about the crypto ecosystem in the Middle East. Can you give us a bit of overview of how big is the crypto ecosystem in the Middle East? What are some of the drivers there? And how do you expect the ecosystem to evolve over the next couple of months and years?
So crypto is actually a very global industry. If you think of where the innovation in e-commerce started, it started in Seattle, Silicon Valley, some of it in China, but it's been primarily centralized in Silicon Valley and then basically Chinese tech companies absolutely killing it, maybe a bit of Europe. But crypto, we see projects from all across the world becoming unicorns. You have a great example with Matic Polygon coming out of India. You have Aave Astani being Finnish and moving to London. So I'm very bullish on innovation, crypto innovations that are going to come out from the Middle East. But we have to remember that products and innovative technology usually follow funding. You can't have innovative startups if you don't have funding. Up until 2-3 years ago, when I was doing my first fundraise for Jibril, VCs would laugh me out of the room when I say, yeah, I'm raising money for a crypto company. I'm like, yeah, that's sci-fi. You know, who cares about that? Now the narrative has changed. So now if you're a crypto business focused on the Middle East, you can raise capital. And that means you could make it or you couldn't, right? Because startups do have a high rate of failure. So yeah, I do think that the crypto ecosystem in the Middle East is going to thrive in the coming years, primarily because I mentioned there's the funding issue that has become available. But also I believe Dubai and the Middle East is situated in a way where you have very, very favorable tax regulations. So if you think of the traditional brain drain problem, the brain drain problem was engineers leaving the developing world to move to the US to work because they could get very good work opportunities. Today, you could have a tax drain where if I'm a resident of France and I don't want to pay, I don't know, 40% capital gains on my Bitcoin, I drop my French residency and I move to sunny Dubai for most of the year and then bounce on the summer. And what I would save in taxes, I can basically buy an apartment in. So there's obviously the regulatory stuff that's important. I think it's also worth noting that Dubai is relentless. You know, you have the Dubai Blockchain Center by Dr. Marwan. You have the DMCC Crypto Valley Initiative. You have the Future Blockchain Summit happening every year. We have like, I don't know, 20 or 15 events happening in October. So, I mean, you know, it's a marathon and not a sprint. And you got to keep on going. And that's what Dubai does best.
Actually, on this point, you know, there's been actually in recent weeks and months, I've been seeing tremendous number of companies around the world move to Dubai, increasing a lot of individuals actually coming and setting up for it. It obviously, you mentioned a lot of the events are taking place, the ecosystem building, a lot of the catalysts are taking place. What do you think is driving this? What do you think is making Dubai attractive? Of course, there's issues like tax you mentioned and the beautiful sun, but what do you think is driving this, and what could be the potential of Dubai as a future global crypto hub?
Yeah, so if you think of what happened to Switzerland after the World War, they basically said, you know what, we don't like this fighting stuff. You know, we don't want to fight with you guys. But if you have gold, you can bring it to our safes and we'll happily custody it for you. And in a world where gold was the reserve asset of the world, Switzerland became very wealthy because they had a lot of financial resources. So I like that analogy because that's what I'm hoping Dubai and Bahrain can become. Because I can tell you that I never expected to go apartment shopping with crypto friends that I used to live. Because I used to live in, after Saudi, I moved to Zug, Switzerland. And the people you meet in Zug, Switzerland aren't really from Zug, Switzerland, right? They have moved from China, they have moved from New York, they have moved from elsewhere in the world to capitalize on regulations that are favorable towards crypto, to banks that accept crypto. Obviously, there is a bit of taxes in Switzerland, not like Dubai. But it's the same type of profile that moves there. And we're seeing that come to Dubai. If you go to any meetups, you'll realize that you're seeing a lot more founders, a lot more engineers. And that's something that takes time. You know, Sequoias of the world set up shop in Silicon Valley in the 70s and 80s. And then they started bearing the fruits of their efforts 10, 20, 30 years down the line. Whereas in the Middle East, we only had a handful of VCs that basically existed when I was born.
Yeah. I think it's interesting you mentioned the VC ecosystem as well. You know, I think one of their big catalysts, Talal, is really with how Dubai has dealt with the COVID crisis. By the time of recording this, I flew in yesterday in Dubai for 24 hours. I have to say, the fact that everything is open, yes, everybody wears a mask, but there's a very pragmatic approach to COVID. I have to say, it's very, very refreshing to see from that perspective. So actually, on this point, Talal, obviously, many of our listeners around the world, you know, obviously, they know the Middle East is a region. But obviously, as you mentioned, within the Middle East, there's numerous different kind of countries. You guys are, for example, regulated by the Central Bank of Bahrain. You're physically right now in Dubai, in the UAE. What if you had to summarize for our international audience kind of the stance that different regulators have taken on crypto around the world and who you think are kind of the top leaders right now when it comes from a regulatory perspective and policymaking perspective?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the larger you are as an economy and the more complex your financial system, the harder it is to regulate, right? If you think of Bahrain is reasonably, in terms of size, it's much smaller than Saudi or the UAE. So they do have the ability or the flexibility to move quicker than others. But I also need to give credit to visionary leadership. The governor, His Excellency, the governor of the Central Bank of Bahrain, as well as the country, have taken a very, very progressive stance when many other were ambiguous and wanted to wait on the sidelines. So this is kind of different from... Okay, so first thing about regulations. It is virtually impossible for financial or technology regulations to keep up with the pace of regulations, right? So it's always that the regulations lag and can't keep up with the advancements of technology. So that's why positioning evergreen regulations is very important, right? The last thing you want to do is over-regulate in something that no one still properly knows. So the Swiss were very smart when it came to this. They said anything related to anti-money laundry, red line. Anything related to securities, they were a little bit more flexible about, right? In the US, they give you this Howey test and you have to go, like, everyone's scared of the SEC, etc. In Switzerland, everyone respects anti-money laundry guidelines because that is very risky. However, on the security side, crypto assets are very hard to define and humans have the tendencies of trying to use previous frameworks to regulate new stuff, trying to say it's an equity or debt or commodity. It's a crypto asset. It's a new type of financial asset. So there's no point boxing it in a previous kind of system. In the Middle East, Bahrain, the Central Bank of Bahrain, has launched a comprehensive crypto framework that regulates exchanges, custodians, basically the whole lot. In the UAE, we have ADGM, Abu Dhabi Global Markets, that had regulated crypto. But it's worth mentioning that is an offshore regulator, so it doesn't regulate the banks. That's not to say anything about the license itself. It's just that it doesn't cover the banks. And now we're seeing in the UAE, ESCA, the Security and Commodity Authority, which is basically a federal entity, look to regulate crypto. I respect governments that take a stance of we're not going to regulate this yet until we get a better understanding. But the worst thing you can do is to outright ban it, because then you have people going to black market options. You have people trying to circumvent those laws. And as has history taught us, it's pointless to stifle regulation to stifle technology with regulation, because it's a losing battle.
And actually, on this point, when we talk about, let's say, from regulators trying to protect our market, when you look at the future of crypto businesses and crypto trading across the Middle East, do you think the demand will come by mainly retail investors or mainly from institutional investors?
I personally think everyone will want crypto exposure. So let's think of the assets that we hold as humans and why we hold them, right? You have investment funds or a pension fund just wants to make enough returns to be able to pay its future cash flows. You have family offices that invest in real estate to generate passive income. You have myself that I might have some money in my wallet that I use to go spend. So to answer your question, I do think that companies, sovereigns, governments, individuals, everyone will hold crypto, similar to how everyone uses the internet today. Like, it's impossible for you to function in today's world if you simply refuse to use the internet. And I do think that we'll start seeing the same in crypto in the coming 5 to 10 years.
But do you think some of the customers across the Middle East have particularities that do not exist in other markets? For example, I know there's a very high usage of mobile, for example, across the Middle East. In many cases, actually, some of the leading percentages of mobile and smartphone users in the world. Do you think the fact that the GCC in the Middle East is so used to using mobile services has an impact of you as a crypto business have to offer services to your clients?
Yeah, I mean, this speaks directly to our target addressable market, right? Because not only do you have a population that is more or less addicted to their smartphones, you have a young population, which means that they are very adaptable to technology and very adaptable to change. For us, this is a very, very, very bullish sign. Until today, Estimates vary, but around 45% of the Middle East is underbanked. That means they don't have access to financial services that me or you or other, let's say, more well-off people have. But we have to remember that we have the luxury of opening Future of Money podcast and accessing it from our MacBooks, but that's not a luxury that everyone has. So basically, the point that I'm trying to get at is if you have a smartphone in 2022 or 2021, you technically can receive money and in the form of crypto and then use that as a form of obtaining financial services. Because let's say I live in Jordan, or a bad example because crypto is still illegal in Jordan, but let's go with it. I receive $1,000 worth of Ethereum. That's an incoming payment to my account. I can then unlock $600 worth of credit via collateralizing that Ethereum and getting a loan against it within 60 seconds. If I go to a Jordanian bank and ask them for a loan, they'll probably reject me because I don't have a salary certificate. So it changes the way people obtain financial services, and it'll be as easy as tweeting right now. Tweeting has become very easy. If you think of how difficult it was to publish something on a newspaper 20 years ago, you need to have a publishing license and book your slot and I don't know what. Now you just tweet while you're, yeah.
And what about, you mentioned obviously that almost half population is unbanked or underbanked, right? I mean, having spent also a lot of time in the Middle East, I always find the topic of financial education being a challenge as well. Actually, on this point, and for full disclosure, I think it's great to announce that Coinmina is not only a sponsor, but also you guys are helping us promote and supporting financial education by sponsoring our Arabic content. How big of a problem do you think this is across the Middle East? Do you think crypto can help when it comes to financial education? You mentioned accessing loans, for example, using crypto as collateral, but do you think it can have a catalyst effect when it comes to changing and creating more awareness on financial education?
Yeah, I mean, I'm an optimist, so obviously I'm going to give you the positive answer, but it's definitely challenging. I do think that Venmo has done an excellent job at that. You know, Venmo is one of my favorite apps. I think the way that they use their mobile app, they have videos embedded that literally teach you anything you need to know about payments, about finance. We'll aim to replicate the same, and that's why we're very happy to be working with you, because we can basically churn out quality educational content that serves two purposes. First is improve the overall awareness of crypto and its potential. And also, obviously, since we're not running a charity, to get people to go and sign up and use Coinmina to access financial services.
Excellent. Actually, on this point as well, you know, there's one of the, you know, if you think for our global audience again, well, obviously, one thing people think about the Middle East, there's obviously one of them is the whole Sharia compliant in many countries, right? What has been the stance on cryptocurrencies from, let's say, a Sharia angle? And is that an obstacle? Is that a catalyst? Or how does that affect business of running a crypto business across the Middle East?
Yeah, so Bitcoin is arguably one of the most Sharia compliant assets out there because it does not involve any type of rehypothecation, doesn't involve any type of fractional reserve banking. So Coinmina is a Sharia compliant exchange. That means we conduct an audit or a Sharia review with the Sharia review board, who are regulated by the Central Bank of Bahrain. And they are the entity that regulates other or reviews other banks and their processes. So they basically go through our processes and make sure that that's Sharia compliant. Funnily enough, it's crazy that the US Federal Reserve is probably the most Sharia compliant central bank in the world at the moment. And it may be crazy to say that, but look at the interest rates that bonds pay in the Middle East. They pay like 3-4%. The US is paying 0%, which is the closest thing to Sharia compliance out there. So it's kind of like we've gone full circle. But yeah, I mean, to be completely honest, the principles of Sharia in finance are ones that mitigate risk, and they're all based on concepts that disincentivize you from taking excessive risk. So I do think that just like what we're seeing in the US now with the rise of ESG, ESG has been embedded into Sharia compliant finance for decades or centuries. I'm bad with these abbreviations, but yeah, it's been there since a very, very long time of what you can invest in and what you shouldn't. And yeah, to be honest, on the Coinmina side, our operations are Sharia compliant. So that's why we said, you know, why not we go out and get that certification? But in the future, we do imagine a world where we have Sharia compliant offerings to that target audience. And then we have other types to suit the respective audience.
And, you know, it's very interesting because obviously Sharia compliance is always a big topic in the Middle East, but also use of gold and ownership of gold has been there also for centuries. Yeah. You see, you know, from weddings to even, you know, investments people make. And obviously in many of the crypto community would say that actually Bitcoin is a better form of gold for some of the reasons our listeners would know. What's your view on that from a Middle East perspective? Do you think that there is now awareness of what is Bitcoin, not only about its Sharia compliance aspects, but also how it can be kind of a better version of gold across the region?
Yeah, I mean, I'm one of those people, right? I think I compare Bitcoin to digital gold. And that's the rationale that it's either that argument or the money of the internet. But let's take why Bitcoin and gold are actually similar. First of all, and in my opinion, probably most importantly, they are self-sovereign. So why do families used to hide gold in their houses? Because if history had taught us anything, is that governments aren't necessarily the most reliable counterparty. And there is a scenario, obviously they mean well, but there is a scenario where a central bank no longer can support its currency. And we've seen that play out in multiple countries. That's why gold is a hedge against that. And you control it. Uncle Sam or any other type of government can't say, you know what, Talal, you have that gold bar in your bedroom. Give it up to me. Like what happened at some point in the past 100 years in the US where they said private ownership of gold was illegal. That is a crazy concept if you think about it, where the government said, you know what, anyone other than us, the government can't own gold. So Bitcoin is a way to have self-sovereign money that you and only you control. It's durable. It doesn't rust. So you can hold it for 10 to 30 years. It doesn't go bad. It's gold supply is scarce. So if you think of gold supply, there's, I think, 200,000 tons of gold above the Earth's surface. And the incremental supply of gold usually increases between 1 and 2.5% per year, which means that it can't be easily debased. And that's one of the most important features of money. I know your podcast is called The Future of Money. And for me, the future of money has to be money that can't be easily debased. This poster behind me is actually from the newspaper that Satoshi references in his white paper, when basically Fed bailed out the banks and the same happened in the UK. That was the debasement of currency. And basically what throughout history, that's been one of the key factors in people losing trust in their currency. The Roman denarii yeah. used to include an amount of gold, and then the government reduced that so that they can spend more. And then it becomes a vicious cycle where people lose trust in the currency. So that can't happen with Bitcoin or gold. Final 2 points on gold and Bitcoin and why Bitcoin can be better. Bitcoin is much easier to transfer. It's divisible by 8 decimals as opposed to gold's ounce or gram, sorry. I think it's this day and age's replacement
for gold. Are you seeing more and more awareness about cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin across the Middle East? I remember a couple of years ago it was not seen as a leader in cryptocurrencies, but are you seeing more awareness, more people being aware of Bitcoin and using and buying even cryptocurrencies?
Yeah, I mean, we see that on the CoinMina level on a day-to-day basis, right? People coming in and signing up. There's definitely been, it's moved from, okay, I was presenting to one of the banks a few weeks ago and one of the senior executives there basically said, I've moved from being crypto skeptic to crypto curious. And that's something that we're seeing across the board. People that previously wrote it off are now opening up to it. And if the bankers are getting in, that basically means everyone else is going to get in because it's meant to disrupt the financial industry. The amount of interest in crypto has exploded in the past year. It's crazy.
So one of the elements I want to talk about, it obviously, is one of the, you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast about investors. Often when people think about the Middle East, they think about the big investors in crypto, not only the family offices and the VC funds, but also sovereign wealth funds and pension funds and the likes. What is the level of interest you are seeing from these investors when it comes to cryptocurrencies and the digital assets more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Middle East is probably known for the sovereign mega funds, whether it's the public investment fund in Saudi, Mubadala, ADQ, Kuwait Investment Authority. Those entities are not publicly listed, which means they do not have to disclose information to the general public the same way a public company has to, but they have to do it to their citizens, right? And I do believe that in the coming couple of years, we will see such entities disclose that they own Bitcoin in one way or form. But I personally think crypto's biggest, one of its biggest strengths is that it democratizes access. Anyone can buy crypto. If you have $100 today, you go on Coinmina, you can buy crypto. The same can't be said about bonds. Maybe now you can do the same with stocks, but you can't do it with pretty much any asset class. And for me, obviously, I'm biased towards what crypto will become. Today, crypto is a $2 trillion market. If you ask anyone whether that number will be $2 trillion or more in the coming 10 years, I think the answer is very, I wouldn't say easy, but it's very logical.
Yeah. And so definitely there's, I think, interest arising from that perspective. And let's see how things evolve from that side. So Talal, I mean, as we wrap it up, I mean, there's one thing also I wanted to ask you. If there's like one message you can give to, but not only people in the crypto community, but, you know, people building businesses and companies around the world about why they should consider the Middle East, what would be your message to them?
Yeah, I mean, why consider the Middle East? If you haven't been to Dubai, you need to visit Dubai first. And then the answer is, my words won't do it justice. Amazing when you see people come to Dubai for the first time and see how a lot of the misconceptions that they had about the Middle East turned out to be wrong. Maybe it's better that you come in September onwards because the summers are pretty brutal. But yeah, I mean, if you think of growth markets, you often look at demographics, age, where, how do people fit in terms of how many years of productivity they still have to give. Across pretty much every metric, the Middle East and Africa as well are markets that are going to have significant growth in the coming 10 or 20 years. If you think of what happened in China as an excellent example in the past 40 years, it's very hard for them to sustain that type of double-digit growth. Whereas in the Middle East, growth has primarily been led by sovereigns or by governments. And now we're starting to see the private sector starting to grow. And hopefully we'll start having those double-digit growth years just like China was able to do in the past decades.
It's impressive, I have to say. You know, I'm a big fan of Dubai, and I spend quite a lot of time there, as you know. And I have to say, there's a lot of misconceptions about Dubai. If somebody has not been there, has not interacted with various stakeholders in the city, I mean, it's very, very impressive. I would say it's probably the one city that impresses me the most, all the way from the governments, regulators, business people, you know, every day. It's very, very impressive. And I think the way they've dealt with the COVID crisis as well, it's a great example of how a city can take a crisis and transform it into an opportunity. Yeah. Absolutely remarkable from that side. So Talal, as we wrap up, the famous bell is back and we're going to do a quick fire round of questions. So I'm going to ask you these quick questions about, I need one or two word answers. Okay, so quickly, the bell will ring it and I need one or two word answers from that perspective. Are you ready?
Sure, yeah.
Excellent. Hope our listeners are ready as well because we're kicking it off. So Talal, if anybody comes to Dubai and there's one food they need to try, what is the one your most recommended dish, not only Dubai, but also the Middle East, everybody should try?
Okay, so Dubai, Bukhtir, fried fish, no menu, whatever they catch that day you have with their spicy curry sauce, that's amazing. And then Middle East, I have to go with mansaf, the Jordanian traditional dish. Just make sure that you don't have anything planned the afternoon after you have it.
If somebody has to spend one day in Dubai, what is the one thing they should visit?
Dubai Mall, actually, like as cliche as that sounds, but Dubai Mall is, I was there a couple of days ago. I was like, shit, it's so huge. Yeah, Dubai Mall would be one of them.
Yeah, but literally everything there, which is quite remarkable. So what do you do in your free time when you're not running Coinmina, Jabral? What are you doing in your free time?
I go a lot to the beach with my wife. I still play a bit of FIFA and I like to play cards with my friends sometimes.
Oh, here we go. Selling again Dubai with the beach idea, which came to my next question. Obviously, you're a semi-pro FIFA player.
Former.
You're right. Yeah. Former. If not FIFA, what is your other favorite game you play online?
Nada. Nothing. I haven't played anything.
Nothing. You're FIFA player.
Yeah. Nothing else. I do one thing and do it very well, but that's it.
Here we go. Specializing as the way to do it. Favorite musician?
Ooh. I would say Shkoon, Syrian-German DJs.
Wow.
Yeah. Arabic Very nice.
What is the one biggest mistake you've done in your life and from which you learned the most?
Oof, that's a tough one. I'll come back to that question.
Here we go. What is your favorite YouTube channel or Netflix series?
Whew.
I don't watch a lot of TV, by the way. Yeah, I wouldn't be able to answer that.
Here we go.
Actually, wait. Casa de Papel. Casa de Papel was one of the shows that I watched.
Here we go.
And I really
Bigs, money related there as well. Okay, if there's one asset outside of Bitcoin and Ethereum that you like, one asset outside of Bitcoin and Ethereum that you like these days, which one is it?
Can it also be a crypto asset? Or
No, of course.
Yeah, I like indices. I like crypto indices. So DeFi index, exchange index. It's basically a basket of underlying currencies. Plus, actually, I do think that USD yields in crypto are some of the most impressive financial instruments out there. You can make double-digit returns on your USD.
I think we could have a whole podcast on that topic, on the USD yields. One other question is, if you could have lunch with one other CEO, could be CEO of any company, business, who would you have one lunch with?
Oof. Elon Musk, probably.
And why is that?
Because you can ask him about, like, I don't know, 50 different industries. Any other CEO, you'd probably ask him about one industry sector. Like this guy, you can ask him payments, PayPal, space exploration, SpaceX, solar. So, you know, it'll be a one-way street of questions and then responses. Yeah, it'd be Elon.
Last two left. What is keeping you up at night, Talal, right now? What is keeping you up at night?
Making CoinMina the biggest crypto business in the Middle East. That's for
beautiful.
Sure.
And to finish it off, you know, for Talal from CoinMina today, what do you think, Talal, will be the price of Bitcoin on December 31st, 2021 and 5 years from now?
$96,000 on this end of the year. And then 5 years down the line, I would say $550,000.
There you go. Very, very bullish views on that perspective. Well, Talal, great to have you with us. How can people keep in touch with you? How can they find you online?
Twitter. Talal Tabba, or like Tabba4, or LinkedIn. Yeah, LinkedIn or Twitter, I guess, work best.
That's excellent.
If you come to Dubai, just ping me and happily have you over at the office.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you very much again, Talal. This was Talal Tabba, the co-founder of CoinMina, a great exchange if you guys are located in the Middle East, are looking for it. But as Talal said, if you are there, feel free to reach out to him from that perspective. I'm sure he'd love to take you to Dubai Mall and make you try some of that fried fish that he told you about as well. Thank you, Talal. Thank you for being with us. And again, thank you everybody for listening to this podcast. Again, make sure to click subscribe if you like the podcast. A new episode will be released every other week. And if you want to stay on top of the latest developments on crypto and the future of money, make sure to follow me on LinkedIn and Twitter, especially my weekly Crypto Capsule show where I summarize the global developments that you need to know in less than 60 seconds. And again, my weekly newsletter, The Future of Money, right? I share every Sunday the three big ideas on the future of money that you need to know each week. And also today we talked about crypto education. If you want to learn more about crypto education, crypto, and being more educated on the topic, make sure to also check out my YouTube channel, where I have not only videos of previous interviews, including this one will be also online, but also a lot of crypto educational videos. And the good news now is all the content now is available in French, Mandarin, English, of course, and also Arabic, powered by CoinMina, on my different YouTube channels in those languages. So thank you very much for joining me today on this episode of the Future Money Podcast, and see you all next time.